Mr. Amos and Mr. Widmer, good morning.
I would be requesting 5 minutes for rebuttal time. May it please the court, my name is Reed Amos. I'm appellate counsel for Mr. Kramer on this appeal. I was not his counsel during the trial. I will first address the first two assignments of error. I think those are the two most poignant. The first error being in this case that the trial court erred when it denied the defendant the right to call his former co-defendant as a witness. The trial court denied that request on two reasons. The first being an objection by the Commonwealth on the rule on witnesses, and the second being that the Commonwealth was objecting that this was improper impeachment for the defense to impeach or try to impeach its own witness. And that own witness being Lynn Moore, who was the wife and also a victim in this case of this grand larceny, supposedly. This was improper for the trial court to do. The first ground, that being the rule on witnesses, is completely inapplicable. It's not even addressed by the Attorney General's brief in opposition, so I won't go into that because I think that's inapplicable for the reasons that's also stated in our appellate brief. I will go to the second ground on which the trial court denied this witness for the impeachment, saying that it was improper impeachment. The Commonwealth argued bluntly, we object to Mr. Kramer calling his former co-defendant as a witness because you can't do that. Impeachment is improper if you try to impeach your own witness that the defense calls. And that is clearly wrong. That is not the law in Virginia. The law in Virginia is clearly delineated in section 8.01-403, which provides specifically for such. In common law error, it wasn't proper for an own party to impeach its own witness. However, in our modern era, under the statute, in both civil and criminal cases, a defendant, in this case a criminal case, can impeach his own witness. Now, I will address the proffer, because I understand that that's what the Attorney General's main contention here is, that the defendant never proffered what this former co-defendant was going to testify to, and because of that lack of a proffer at this point, the appeal should basically be denied. However, I would ask the rhetorical question here of what would a proffer at that moment, when the defendant tried to call his former co-defendant, what proffer of that evidence, or what evidence proffered, would have provided any new information to the trial court? There would have been none. Because the only two contentions for denying the witness was this rule on witnesses, which is just not a good ground at all, and improper impeachment. Both parties and the trial court knew that the defendant was calling his former co-defendant to testify for impeachment purposes, mainly. So a proffer at that point would not have added anything to the trial court's determination, which was basically a procedural determination, not a substantive one. This wasn't something where the defense or the Commonwealth was arguing that this was a relevance issue. It was a procedural ground. So a proffer would not have added anything to the trial court's determination. But yet the two grounds that the trial court used, the rule on witnesses and improper impeachment, were not good grounds. And that would be the first error. And I would say impeachment would have been proper at this point because the defendant was calling his former co-defendant to testify against Lynn Moore. Lynn Moore had been called by the defendant. She had testified bluntly that we did not give the defendants the consent to take the furniture out of the house when they left it. The understanding between the parties was that this was a rent-to-own agreement and that the furniture would only go with the defendants if they bought the house. Her testimony, and she was a witness by the first witness called by the defendant, is adverse to the defendant's theory on the case, which was that they did get consent. They did have consent to take the furniture out when they left, even if they didn't buy the house. So under 8.01-403, which provides for impeachment of one's own witness, the requirement being that that testimony prove adverse, her testimony was, in fact, adverse. Not only that, but But the statute specifically requires not only that it proves adverse, but two, that it, or that the counsel ask that witness about that statement, which defense counsel did. He specifically asked her, were you present during this negotiation? And she said yes. And this is what my understanding was, which was adverse to the defendant's case. Therefore, it would have been proper for the defense to be able to impeach her testimony with this former co-defendant. I would address one specific issue.
Can I ask you about the rent-to-own contract? And that deals with this assignment of error, this first one to some degree, and especially the third one. The rent-to-own contract talks about how you end up owning the property eventually. But there's nothing in there about the furniture, is there?
Not that I've seen, Your Honor. And my understanding that the aspect about the furniture was a verbal agreement between the parties when they were negotiating this rent-to-own agreement. And my understanding is that rent-to-own agreement was basically a boilerplate agreement that Lynn Moore had gotten off the internet. And that the furniture was not specifically talked about in that, but that's where the contention was about whether there was consent or not for the defendants to leave with the furniture. I would address one brief issue on this first assignment of error as well, brought up by the Attorney General's opposition, that defense counsel was inviting error. But if we look at the specific words of defense counsel when they're arguing about the impeachment, he specifically said, quote, whose testimony he heard, meaning he's referring to the co-defendant. The co-defendant, and I'll take a step back for a moment, the co-defendant was not present when Lynn Moore was called by the defense. He was outside the courtroom. His case was over because his counsel had made a motion to strike at the close of the Commonwealth's evidence, and that motion to strike was granted. He then left the courtroom and was not present when Lynn Moore testified. And therefore here, in a somewhat conciliatory manner, defense counsel was arguing, well, I won't use him to impeach the Commonwealth's witnesses, but, quote, I will basically use, well, excuse me, the quote here is whose testimony he heard, meaning that he's saying, I am going to use him to testify against Lynn Moore. So he was only referring to the Commonwealth's witnesses at that point. So he was not inviting error, he was simply saying that he wanted to use Davis, which was the co-defendant, to impeach Lynn Moore. Now, as to the proffer issue, which is a second assignment of error, defense counsel did make a proffer of what Davis would have testified to, albeit he did it at sentencing, as opposed to at the time at trial when it was denied by the trial court.
Do you think that the attorney's proffer was sufficient to preserve the issue, or obviously in hindsight, wouldn't it have been better to have elicited the testimony of the particular witness?
I think the case law says ideally it is better to have that done at the moment that the evidence is denied.
Well, even if it hadn't been done at the moment the evidence is denied, just because the attorney proffered what that testimony would be, isn't it incumbent upon the defendant or the appellant here to have whoever his witness is to have that person testify under oath as to what that testimony would be so we could review it here?
I think ideally that would be the best. However, under Whitaker, that case law says that it can be a unilateral avowal by one of the parties, which is what was done here by defense counsel. At least defense counsel did submit a writing saying, this is what I expected Mr. Davis to say on the witness stand. Although that was done at sentencing, the main contention by the trial court and by the Commonwealth was it was untimely, and therefore we're denying its consideration.
Was anything under oath, ultimately, as far as the...
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. But again, if it had just been a unilateral avowal at the time by counsel, I'm not sure what a big difference that would have been at the time, because the trial court did not want to hear anything as far as what the substance of of that witness would have provided at that point. But again, timeliness was the objection, and that's what the trial court ultimately based its denial on of the proffers. However, Lowry v. Commonwealth, the 1990 case, specific on this point, and that in this court said a proffer can be made at the time that the evidence is denied or after verdict. Here, defense counsel did do that, and he says, I'm doing this not to reopen evidence, not to say, hey, the trial court made an error, because that's a different assignment of error, as it is in our brief. I'm doing this to complete the record for appeal. That way the Court of Appeals can know if there was prejudice or not by the denial of that witness's testimony. And here, what he provided to the court was enough. If we look at that proffer of testimony, in that it says Davis would have testified as to the opposite of what Lynn Moore testified to, which would have been an important consideration. I see I'm about 4 minutes here. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Judge Schaaf, and may it please the court. Stephen Whitmer here on behalf of the Commonwealth today. Because counsel has directed this court's attention to the proffer, I would ask the court to look at the proffer on page 139 of the appendix. The proffer that has been made in this case, even if it were timely, does not suggest a use to impeach the same witness that counsel's brief says it would have been used to impeach. Mr. Davis would have been testified that he had been present when Edward Moore removed several items from the residence he rented to the defendant, including items Moore later identified as having been stolen from the home. He would have testified that it was his understanding that the defendant could keep or dispose of items that were left in the home. And he would testify that Moore, in that context, Mr. Moore, had not returned often to the home during the lease period, contradicting Mr. Moore's testimony at trial. This is not a proffer of impeachment evidence with respect to Mrs. Moore, which is the use to which it is suggested the testimony would have been put had it been admitted into evidence. That having been said, this proffer clearly was untimely. We have a ruling by the trial court specifically applying the rule announced in Shiflett, which is that the proffer would have been of assistance to the trial judge in ruling on the question of admissibility. And while this witness, I would agree the witness technically was not present in the courtroom in violation of the rule on witnesses because he was a co-defendant, it is also true that the witness did hear all of the Commonwealth's evidence. And thus, it would have been within the discretion of the trial court to exclude a witness who had the opportunity to tailor his testimony in light of the Commonwealth's evidence. We're here on an abuse of discretion standard with respect to the admissibility of the testimony of this witness, and such a decision by the trial court certainly would have withstood review under that standard. Lastly, with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence, that claim clearly has been waived. The defendant specifically indicated he was not making a motion to strike at the conclusion of the evidence, and the trial court never considered whether the evidence was legally sufficient, but only considered the question of whether the trial court itself was finding reasonable doubt, and for that reason the sufficiency claim has been waived. I'd be happy to answer any questions the court may have.
Mr. Whitman, I first thought that you had not relied on Shiflett. I see that you have actually in the brief, and in reviewing that opinion, it was opinion by Justice Compton, in which he pretty emphatically in his comments took this court to task and said, when there's been a proffer of this type, it needs to be timely made, and it needs to be very narrow in what it points out. And he said for the trial court to go beyond that or to consider it later was error. Now, there are some distinctions that can be drawn with Shiflett because it was a jury trial, whereas this is a bench trial. Just the way it was developed by being a bench trial, it might not be applicable here, but in theory, as far as the whole purpose of his opinion is to narrow the trial judge's focus right at that time so the trial judge has before it all it needs to make during the And this was during the sentencing phase in Shiflett, whereas this is the guilt phase. But still, it seems to me Shiflett is so narrow, if I hear Justice Compton correctly, it would control. And I'm going to ask Mr. Amos, I guess, about that to help me with the Shiflett case. But Shiflett, one of the main cases, I guess I'm asking you, that you're relying on here to say that it was an untimely proffer in this case.
We clearly do rely upon Shiflett for the proposition that this was an untimely proffer. And in part, we rely on it because that is the ruling the trial court made. Trial court specifically ruled that it would have been helpful to the trial court in making a correct ruling on admissibility to have the proffer. And I realize this is a bench trial, which is a somewhat different procedural situation. But the real question that the real place that puts us, I think, is if we look at, well, gee, it's a trial court and the matter is still within the breast of the trial is still within the breast of the court until the final order has been entered and for 21 days thereafter. And in theory, a trial judge can go back and reconsider. We would then almost be in a situation where we're looking at the question of whether the trial court abused its discretion in not reopening the case, reconsidering the ruling on admissibility, and then taking new evidence. And the defendant certainly hasn't met any burden of showing that the trial court would have abused its discretion in not reopening the evidence at this stage once the parties, you know, have rested and the case is closed. So for those reasons, I would suggest, notwithstanding that there is some narrow language in Shiflett, and notwithstanding that Lowry addresses situations in which a trial court may be able to consider a proffer not made at the time the objection to the witness testimony is before the court, this court nonetheless should affirm.
Whitner, putting Shiflett aside for a minute, if a proffer is offered just to complete the record, to make sure it's in the record for appeal, why should it matter when it's proffered?
Well, our trial court in this case found that it mattered, found that it would have been helpful to have that information to make the decision on admissibility, and that really is the consideration that Shiflett addresses in the context of timeliness. This court,
presumably you don't know if it's going to be helpful till it's offered, I guess. But
presumably you don't know whether. I mean, the proffer is the opportunity to show for a defendant to show the trial judge. Judge, I know you've ruled, but this is what he would say, and this is why that ruling is wrong. Provides the defendant with the opportunity to ask the trial judge to reconsider, to perhaps make, if justified, a different ruling to avoid error, to avoid an unnecessary appeal. That's what procedural default is all about. It's about giving the trial judge the opportunity to make the right call in the first instance so that the case doesn't have to come before this court on an appeal asking this court to decide an issue really for the first time on what is now a more complete record, notwithstanding that it's our position that the proffer doesn't do what the defendant says it would do.
Yeah, but that's exactly what we had to take into consideration before Shiflett. I mean, the Court of Appeals decision in Shiflett took that very thing into consideration, because during a trial, particularly a jury trial, most of the time trial judges don't admit the proffer at that time. I mean, you don't disrupt the jury trial to take the proffer. You wait. We'll take the proffer at a later time. And that may be what gives me some heartburn still about the Shiflett case. Justice Compton would not appreciate my saying that at this point, but it seems to me that Shiflett said you've got to get a trial judge the opportunity at that time to make the correct ruling on very narrow grounds, and if you don't, you haven't preserved it for appeal, and we're not going to consider it. Isn't that what Shiflett said?
That is what Shiflett says, and Justice Compton, when I appeared before him, always seemed to know the law better than I did. In this, you know, we have a remedy in a jury trial. I mean, yes, as a trial practitioner, one can argue, or as a trial judge, one can argue that taking this proffer will interrupt sort of the flow of a case. But, you know, parties make proffers all the time. The jury is excused, or the jury stays there. The parties and the court reporter go into the judge's office to take the proffer. That's the way we do things to preserve them for the record.
Well, and two, I mean, I am thinking about the effects of Shiflett, and if assuming I'm correct in what my interpretation is here, if you did that and the trial and the judge, you said, I want to make the proffer now, and the judge says, we'll reserve it for later, and they said to the judge, look at Shiflett, what Shiflett says, I need to do it now, and he says, okay, you've preserved it for appeal, I understand what Shiflett says, and I'm not going to, we'll still take it later. Perhaps that would satisfy Shiflett, but it seems to me that's sort of the scenario that would have to work out.
I think the appellate claim in that instance is the trial court abused its discretion in not permitting the defendant to make a proffer at the time the ruling was made to exclude the testimony that he wanted. I think that would be the assignment of error in that case. Thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr.
A tough road for defense counsel to pursue, isn't it? And during the course of a trial. Right, Mr. Amos?
Yes, sir. I would first address Shiflett. I would put forward to this court that it is distinguishable on one ground, being Shiflett was decided on relevance. This is not a relevance issue. Here, the trial court denied the defense the ability to call Mr. Davis as a witness because of the rule on witnesses and improper impeachment, which are procedural grounds. In Shiflett, that was about relevance at sentencing, what the defendant could bring in for sentencing purposes, and that was all about relevance. So the substance of that proffer was very important to the court and important to the determination of whether it should be allowed in or out. This case is distinguishable. It's more in the lines of Lowry. Lowry regarded a denial of a request for a recess, and the Court of Appeals in that said there was no proffer, we can't determine prejudice, and therefore there's no way we can determine if prejudice occurred, that therefore the appeal is denied. Here we also have a procedural ground by which the by which the witness was not allowed to testify, but we have a proffer, albeit at sentencing. And in that proffer, I would respectfully disagree with the Attorney General's office. That sentence, it looks like it's the second sentence where it says, in the proffer regarding Mr. Davis, and this is on page 139 of the joint appendix, at the very bottom, Mr. Davis, quote, Mr. Davis would have testified that it was his understanding that the defendant could keep or dispose of the items that were left in the home, close quote. That is directly at odds as to what Lynn Moore, the first witness called by the defendant, would have testified, or what she did testify to.
Mr. Amos, but my problem with Shiflett is that Shiflett is a timeliness matter. And he says, if I read Shiflett correctly, Justice Compton said the proffer had to be at the time of the objection. And to do it later, as was done here, it's untimely. Therefore, even if it was on the proper grounds, even if it came in later and was on the proper grounds, it was not timely, and it didn't give the trial judge at that moment an opportunity to rule on it, which makes a lot of sense, particularly in a jury trial. But I've, you know, intellectually, I guess I'm having some trouble finding out how we would distinguish that here, where that was what the trial judge ruled at the time, and...
Yes, sir, and I understand where the court is coming from with that question. However, I just believe that there are distinguishing grounds here, because in essence, we're saying that Lowry is at odds with Shiflett. But here, what I'm saying is that when the determination is other than relevance, where the substance of the actual proffer is necessary for the trial court to make that determination,
okay,
there is a difference, and therefore the proffer should be allowed at a later time, not to reopen evidence, just to complete the record for prejudice determinations by this court, which here, we have a problem because there was that or it did cause prejudice. The fact that the defendant was not able to call a witness on his behalf was a constitutional...
But excuse me, Schiff, it goes away from that and says it's just not to preserve it for this court. And that's what the holding seems to be, one of the holdings in Schiff, it is. It's not just to preserve it for this court. It's to allow the trial judge at that moment that he made the ruling to make the correct ruling.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I believe there's dual purposes to that, though. And here being that...
Is your argument, though, following up on Judge Coleman's question, that is it your argument that since it's a bench trial, it doesn't matter as much? Because with the jury, I mean, the jury is going to retire at some point, but the trial judge has jurisdiction until he rules and then 21 days thereafter. So is that part of your argument or not?
Not so much, Your Honor, to be honest. I was focusing more on what the substance of the proffer and the ground by which the trial court is making that determination at that point. And here I'm just saying there's a difference. One is looking at almost beyond what's the door of the proffer, what is actually the substance of the proffer, as opposed to the grounds here, which are procedural grounds, which wouldn't have made the defense contention is that it would have made a difference one way or the other, knowing the actual substance. Because here it was just whether the defense could impeach its own witness. And the defense is saying it should have been able to do that, or at least try. But because of the proffer was made at sentencing, it still gives this court the opportunity to look and say, hey, well, that denial was a denial of a constitutional right, and therefore prejudice resulted.
Thank you, Mr. Amos. Are there any other questions? We'll come down and we can...